Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's clinical focus is on medical epic fails. These are some of the things that we've urged patients to do in medicine, but have turned out, based on research, to be wrong or even harmful. And in part one, we considered five of them. We've got another five to reel off for you. There's a companion article at drhoffman.com that you can read on this subject. But let's tackle our next medical epic fail, which is number six, taking common painkillers after you've had a heart attack. Okay, how many people who've had heart attacks have aches and pains? I mean, usually the very same people who've had heart attacks are usually older, they're arthritic, they've got back pain, they've got knee pain. And so what they do is they just go to the drugstore and they get some Advil, Aleve, Motrin, ibuprofen. These medications are called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And they're easy to get. And, you know, what's the big deal? You know, you're taking a medicine that, you know, virtually half the population of the United States takes. So where's the problem? Well, it turns out there is a problem, because after a heart attack, many patients are placed on blood thinners like aspirin and or Plavix. These are blood thinners that are used because people get stents. A stent is like a little device that props open the arteries. And the problem with stents is that they tend to be sticky to platelets. So you have to use a blood thinner whenever you have a stent. It turns out that if you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, you are more likely to suffer a subsequent heart attack or stroke. Why is that? Well, because in spite of the reputation of NSAIDs to cause gastrointestinal bleeding, they're notorious for causing ulcers and gastrointestinal bleeding. But paradoxically, they reverse the effects of these blood thinners that are necessary to prevent blood clots in your arteries. So it's double trouble. You can actually get gastrointestinal bleeding, but you could also get a blood clot, paradoxically. And so this is very disconcerting, because there's just so many people who've had heart attacks who think nothing of taking one of these medications, unless they get a very specific warning from their doctor. And all too often, that's the devil's in the details. The doctor doesn't make mention of that as a possible risk. And by the way, you know, you might say, well, oh, you got to take those for, you know, I just take one here and there. Well, it turns out that if you take these medications, even for as short a period as a few days, they can dramatically increase the risk of serious bleeding. So that's pretty significant. Okay, epic fail number seven is a condition that is referred to as hiatal hernia. Hiatal hernia is sometimes invoked as a reason to put patients on acid blockers for life. And I hear this again and again. You know, patients have a little heartburn. They immediately get scoped. And when they get scoped, the doctor says, well, you know, you have a hiatal hernia. And the patient goes, well, what's that? And I go, well, you know, that's a condition where you don't have good closure between your stomach and your esophagus. There's like a hernia where there's an outpocketing of your stomach through your diaphragm, and it's a structural abnormality, and it means that you need to take antacids to prevent the damage caused by the acid that's backflowing up your esophagus. And so patients go, okay, well, you know, that's, doc, that sounds pretty serious. Okay, well, I'd certainly want to protect my esophagus, so I will duly take acid blockers. How long do you think I need to take the acid blockers? Oh, well, the doctor will say, you can take them forever because the hiatal hernia is not going to go away. It's a permanent condition. And so, you know, doctor prescribes the medication, which is Prilosex, Protonix, Nexium, what have you. The patient clicks his or her heels, salutes, and says, aye, aye, sir, and that's it. Now you have a lifetime prescription for acid-blocking medication. The problem with these acid-blocking medications is that they interfere with absorption of nutrients. There's now a black box warning on every acid blocker, which states that it can cause low levels of magnesium. Magnesium is very important for heart function, for overall energy. It's involved in virtually every energy reaction in the body. And also you can get critical deficiency of B12. You can become osteoporotic. Whenever you take acid blockers for a long period of time, you become dependent on them. So when you stop, you sometimes have more pain and you think you really need to be on the acid blocker, but it's actually a rebound hyper secretion of stomach acid. So these are ideal medications for the pharmaceutical industry. People get hooked on them. It's very hard to taper. In addition, you are more likely to get a terrible type of diarrhea called C. difficile diarrhea, which I now read kills 30,000 Americans every year. 30,000 Americans die of C. difficile diarrhea. And I bet a very high percentage of them are on these powerful acid blockers because they render you more susceptible to C. difficile. Also, if you're planning to go to Mexico or some exotic place or on a cruise, because you're destroying your stomach acid, you're more likely to get some sort of intestinal pathogen. The acidity in your stomach actually is a barrier to the entry into your body of harmful bacteria, which can cause gastrointestinal ailments like, you know, traveler's diarrhea, Montezuma's revenge. So when we see these cruise ship outbreaks, I wonder if they should really do a study to see how many of the people on these cruise ships who are primarily older have been on these powerful acid blockers. They probably, and not everybody on the cruise ship always gets sick. It's, you know, a certain percentage of people get sick, you know, maybe a few hundred, but the rest of the people don't get sick. What differentiates them? Perhaps for some, it's the presence or absence of an acid blocker. So what's the deal on hiatal hernia? Well, you think, well, gee, that's a, you know, sounds like a pretty irreversible condition. And if I have it, I guess that renders me more susceptible to heartburn. And then, of course, they'll raise the specter of you could get cancer. Well, very, 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 very tiny percentage of people get Barrett's esophagus, which is, and an even tinier percentage of those get esophageal cancer from excess acidity. And it's not actually been proven conclusively that acid-blocking medications are effective at preventing esophageal cancer, but let's leave that argument aside. What do you think is the frequency of hiatal hernia? You know, I ask this when my patients tell me that they have hiatal hernia. I say, okay, well, you know, you think that's unusual. What do you think is the frequency of hiatal hernia in people over 50? And they usually go, well, 5%, 10%, maybe 15, 20%. Actually, the majority of people age 50 or older have a hiatal hernia, 60%. And that likelihood is dramatically increased by obesity, because if you have a big belly, it's going to push your stomach upward, it's going to push it against the diaphragm, and you'll herniate, just as, you know, more likely you'll have an inguinal hernia if you're obese. You have big abdominal contents that puts pressure on the weakened tissue in your groin, and it might push out the hernia. So my experience, though, is that the vast majority of people, even if they have a diagnosis of hiatal hernia, they're fine if they follow the right diet, if they lose weight, if they sometimes undertake measures like sleeping a little bit on an angle to avoid reflux, or simply stop eating at 6 or 7 at night instead of eating really late and then lying down immediately where the food can reflux upwards. Digest your food before you lie down. And the right supplements like DGL or probiotics or Endofen. I really like Endofen from a company called Metagenics. That is a very, very effective supplement for heartburn or GERD, and really creates a lot of gastric repair so that people can get off their acid-blocking medications. So it's not, you've got hiatal hernia, that's that's not an excuse to be on acid-blocking medications for the rest of your life. Rethink it if you're told, oh, you have a hiatal hernia. All right. Number eight, antibiotics used unnecessarily for bronchitis, ear infections, or sinusitis. Now, you might say, Dr. Altman, I get it. I already know that if I just have a cold, I know that antibiotics are futile against a viral infection. I get that. And the flu, similarly, is a viral infection, so I know enough not to take an antibiotic. But if I get bronchitis, where it's deep in my chest and I'm coughing up yellowish mucus, or if I get sinusitis, you know, not just a runny nose, but it's thick, it's tenacious mucus. I've got a sense of my face is like cement. Or a child has an ear infection and gunk's coming out of their ear. That's a bacterial infection, and antibiotics are very effective against bacteria. This is precisely what we're taught in medical school. We were taught that, you know, when to give an antibiotic. Well, don't give an antibiotic if the mucus is clear. But once the mucus is yellowish or greenish or dark, that's a bacterial infection. Give an antibiotic. Makes sense, right? But according to studies, the vast majority of bronchitis, sinusitis, and otitis, that's ear infections, respond minimally to antibiotics. I say, you know, people ask, should I take an antibiotic? I go, well, you know, you'll be sick for a week if you don't take it, and you'll be relieved in 7 days if you do take it. You know, it appears that the antibiotic is beneficial because most of these are self-limited infections anyway. So it's like, yeah, the doctor gave me an antibiotic, I was better. Oh, next time I'm sick, I'm going to make sure I get an antibiotic because it really worked that last time. Well, most of these conditions are self-limited. Now, there are instances where bronchitis is serious in a patient who has damaged lungs, or perhaps a patient is on their way to pneumonia, they're immunocompromised, maybe they do need an antibiotic. That's a doctor's call, and doctors should be very conservative about it. Similarly with sinusitis, and, you know, I just got an email from an old patient of mine. Do you treat a sinusitis that's no longer responsive to antibiotics? That's a classic question. There's so many people who have taken millions of antibiotics for, not millions, but scores of antibiotics for sinusitis. They no longer respond. Sinusitis is not just a bacterial infection. So the use of antibiotics sometimes is a matter of doctors sort of mollifying their patients. You know, you got to do something. So instead, you can't tell impatient patients, like, look, just wait it out. Look, I'll give you something. Oh, good. You gave me something. Great. Thanks, doc. Doctors, even though some of them may be aware that studies now do not substantiate the use of antibiotics in these infections, they still give you something. And part of it is also a CYA move, a cover your certain part of your anatomy move, because there's a liability in not treating infections if they get worse. You know, you could get some blowback from your patient, or even potentially a lawsuit for not prescribing an antibiotic. Now, of course, you know, why, if antibiotics are pretty innocuous, why not prescribe them? Well, they are not innocuous. We're learning more and more that just the act of giving an antibiotic changes your intestinal flora. That could be very damaging to your overall immune system. It may have an impact on so many things. It disrupts your microbiome. This may even have an impact on your metabolism, making you more likely to have insulin resistance, obesity, irritable bowel syndrome, and even increasing the risk of allergies. When we give kids antibiotics, they have a higher risk of asthma, for example, and other allergies. So giving an antibiotic should be, you know, pretty thoughtful consideration when all else fails. And of course, there are natural remedies for these minor infections that, you know, herbal medicines. In some cases, our patients, we instruct them, if they feel sick, come and get an intravenous vitamin C. Vitamin C is a great natural antibiotic that when we give it intravenously, it doesn't affect the gastrointestinal tract and has a killing effect on many infections. We're in the nasal passages, the respiratory tract, and so on. Plus, it even has a bit of an antiviral effect, whereas antibiotics don't. So these are some considerations. Next time, you know, you think you want to reach for an antibiotic and you think that's going to be a quick fix, think again, because the studies don't really support that. Okay, unnecessary heart stents is number 9. And heart stents are these little devices that they put in to prop up your arteries when they're blocked. And this has really revolutionized our care of heart disease. And we know that if you have a heart attack and you have dying heart muscle, putting in a stent can actually save your heart muscle. So emergency stents really save lives and keep people from getting severe destruction of their heart muscle. However, a lot of stents that are being done in this country are unnecessary. This is not just my declaration. This is by the evaluation of the medical establishment itself, because you can extrapolate this phenomenon of putting a stent in from the emergency stent to the elective stent, which means, oh, you got a stress test, it's slightly abnormal, or you've gotten an EBT heart scan and it shows some plaque. And then we say, gee, you have a partially blocked artery. We'll just prop it open with a stent. Makes sense. If you're a plumber and you see that there's a pipe that might clog, you might ask the homeowner, don't wait till it clogs, I'll fix it for you now. But when it comes to the heart, there's actually not a lot of evidence that doing that is going to save lives or reduce the risk of heart attack. And in fact, there are complications of stents. Stents can cause bleeding, they can cause heart attacks, strokes, and often once you put them in, they'll close up within a very short period of time, necessitating re-stenting, which is a big problem. Plus, if you get a stent, as I mentioned in part one, we talked about people who are on blood thinners because of stents. You have to be on a blood thinner, sometimes for life, and that is not inconsequential because then you can have a higher risk of bleeding. So, there are all far too many stents done in the United States, 700,000 done annually. That was a figure from a few years ago. There's probably more now. Half of them, it's estimated, are unnecessary, unwarranted. And it's just going to keep on going because doctors are eager to, A, help people, B, there's a vested interest in doing it because there's a profit motive associated with performing stents. And there's also a CYA element. It's like, you can't leave a patient alone who you find blockage in because, God forbid, you saw blockage, you didn't do a stent, so doctors run and scared. They say, well, I'd rather put in a stent than leave that patient untreated. And that's the way it goes. And therapies like chelation therapy or targeted supplementation and aggressive diet modification, these are often shunted to the side by zealous doctors who would rather give you statins and put in stents. That's really the two main bulwarks of our approach to prevention of heart disease in this country, unfortunately, are stents and statins. Whereas there's so much we could do with lifestyle modification. I think we could reduce heart disease by 90% by undertaking some of these natural therapies. And finally, here's another one, number 10 in our cavalcade of medical epic fails, is the use of, quote, routine antibiotics for heart murmurs. This is sometimes referred to as prophylaxis. And if that sounds like a familiar word, prophylactic is a fancy word for a condom. A birth control device. Prophylaxis means to prevent. And so patients with heart murmurs, until recently, were told, if you've got a heart murmur, you need an antibiotic every time you get a routine procedure. If you go to the dentist and they even clean your teeth, and I had my teeth cleaned recently, it's pretty aggressive. They go in deep to the gums. And when they do that, they actually may seed your bloodstream with bacteria. Now, in an ordinary person, that gets handled very rapidly. Your system takes care of these bacteria that float around for a few minutes, and then they're disposed of. But if you have a jagged heart valve, or if you have a prosthesis in your hip or your knee, the surface of those... the surface irregularities of those can actually attract bacteria. The bacteria can stick on there and you can get an infection That's very hard to treat deep within the body. When it's in the heart, it's called endocarditis, and that requires weeks of intravenous antibiotics. It's a real problem. So because this is such a devastating potential problem, it was recommended that everyone with a heart murmur get antibiotics prior to even a routine dental procedure. You know, say you're pulling a tooth, or if you're getting your teeth cleaned, take an antibiotic. And this has been out for years and years, tens of millions of patients, hundreds of millions of doses of antibiotics, until it was recognized that only patients with the most severe valvular abnormalities really at risk. There's millions and tens of millions of patients with mitral valve prolapse. I wrote a book on the subject many years ago, and it's still making the rounds, still very popular. Just merely having a heart murmur, ordinary mitral valve prolapse, does not predispose you to endocarditis if you have a routine procedure. So they literally changed the rules in 2006. I've been saying for years and years, look, I don't know what to tell you, because they're telling me that the rules are that everybody must get an antibiotic around dental procedures. So far from me to contradict your cardiologist or your dentist, but I think that that's overkill. Well, finally, they officially overturned that because they recognized that antibiotics aren't innocuous. We're creating lots of antibiotic resistance. We're creating other problems in people's gastrointestinal tracts by disrupting their intestinal flora, which we're coming to appreciate more and more plays a role in our health. And so the blanket requirement for antibiotics was only officially dropped in 2006. And I, in an article that you can find on my website, you can find the established guidelines, which are, they're actually a little complicated. There are certain, you know, criteria for when you really, really, really need an antibiotic. If you've had an artificial heart valve, if you had an artificial hip or knee, if you have a very extreme form of a valvular abnormality, and that's usually for a cardiologist to tell you, no, you don't have just run-of-the-mill mitral valve prolapse. You've got a very jagged, irregular heart valve that is more likely to trap bacteria, and therefore she's going to recommend that you get antibiotic prophylaxis every time you have a minor procedure. That does make sense, but the blanket recommendation doesn't. So consult your doctor before you're, because sometimes you go to the dentist and the dentist said, you have a heart murmur? He just writes you the antibiotic prescription or hands you an antibiotic. That's not good medicine, because we should be much more careful about our intake of antibiotics. They are very consequential. So there you have it. And in future editions of Intelligent Medicine, I'm sure I can think of some more medical epic fails. But those are 10 of them that you and your loved ones should try to avoid, because they're just not scientifically substantiated. They don't pass muster. And you need to be a savvy medical consumer, or else you'll succumb to pitfalls like these. And it is a confusing world of healthcare. It's ever-changing, and we need to arm ourselves as consumers with the latest information in order to avoid succumbing to unnecessarily overly invasive, over-the-top treatment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.